We have an excellent visiting mentor this morning, the Reverend Dr. Sid Hall, minister of Trinity United Methodist Church here in Austin, with whom Davidson is swapping pulpits today. We welcome Reverend Hall and appreciate him visiting us, and we hope that your congregation also is enjoying Davidson's visit.
I invite you to be in a spirit of reflection and prayer as I share these words from your hymnal, W.E.B. Du Bois, the great African-American reformer and educator. Now is the accepted time, not tomorrow, not some more convenient season. It is today that our best work can be done, and not some future day or future year. It is today that we fit ourselves for the greater usefulness of tomorrow. Today is the seed time. Now are the hours of work. And tomorrow comes the harvest and the playtime. It is a great joy for me to be back in your midst after, I think, about a year it's been. And knowing that Davidson is over at Trinity, and having heard from folks all through the year, wondering when they would transfer over to First Unitarian Church, how wonderful his sermons are. I appreciate that opportunity for the exchange. I'm going to share a reading from you from the Gospel of Thomas, reading number 70, where Jesus said, "If you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you." I'll read that again a little bit later. When Davidson and I talked, we batted around a couple different ideas to discuss, and I shared with him that one of the things that has been very helpful for me in the last few years is reading the mystics of various traditions, as some people that we don't even think of as mystics, both within Christianity and especially I've found great meaning in those outside of my tradition of Christianity, and seeing the connections that they share, the ideas that they share, also noticing the differences, but in the midst of a different language, a different mythology, common themes, common ideas, and thought I might share with you some of that journey for myself, and hopefully in that reflection it will be of help for you as well. When I was around 7 years old, I got up from a nap and looked outside after a heavy rainstorm and saw the light of the sun back behind the house, reflecting on a beautiful red barn across the way. And the sky behind it had that deep, dark blue that's reflective of a storm. And I can remember seeing that and thinking how beautiful it was, feeling its beauty, and even feeling teary. And I went downstairs, and my mother had run in town to go to the grocery store, so no one was home, and I remember feeling the need to tell someone how beautiful it was. And when she got home, I said, "I saw the neatest thing. It was the sun was shining on the barn, and there was blue behind it." And she said, "Well, that's what the sky looks like when there's a storm." And I said, "Well, I know, but that's not. But it was beautiful." And she says, "Well, of course it was beautiful." And I'm like, no, this is... And I realized at that moment that it was impossible to capture in words, even if I could explain exactly what was happening. I could not describe the feeling, that aesthetic value, that sense of greater connection. And I would remember that through the years, that sense of connectedness. When I was in high school, I had a similar encounter lying out on a dock one night and seeing the northern lights move across the sky. Having studied them in science, I knew what they were, but what I felt was something entirely different. That feeling was this sense of beauty, the sense of connection, the sense that all of this is to be revered in a sense. And those were the experiences that I drew from that led me into ministry. It wasn't the intellectual stuff that I later found to be incredibly fulfilling, but it was that those things, those feelings, those ideas that seem to move beyond words are part of that aesthetic. The mystical, although I didn't identify as that. In fact, I kind of heard of mysticism when I was growing up, but thought of it as that sort of weird stuff believing in ghosts and all sorts of stuff, which I didn't really ever believe. I was much more cynical than that. And so it took me a while to figure out that maybe mysticism wasn't about the extraordinary, but it was about seeing the ordinary in an extraordinary way. That was the shift for me that took a while to get. In high school, I had a mystical kind of experience through the community that I shared. I was a part of that that Jesus movement in the late 60s and early 70s. And you know, I had this real strong sense that Jesus was there with me. And it was sort of this anthropocentric figure who was a little bit older than me, but not as old as my parents, a little bit cooler than my parents, but still somewhat of an authority that I could trust, someone that sort of walked with me. And sort of like an old hippie guy, youth director, you know, that's who Jesus was. And at some point in my cynicism, I began to question that very narrow anthropocentric idea of God or the divine, and moved away from Jesus as the one walking with me and began to see him more as a historical figure that I wanted to learn about and know about, but certainly not see as walking with me. But in the midst of giving that up, I felt a loss of connection, that assurance that there was somebody there. And you know, I didn't have the negative childhood religious experiences, the fundamentalism. My parents were liberals who were freaked out when I got into Jesus. So that button-pushing thing just never really happened for me until, you know, I became an adult, and then I've had plenty of experiences of that. But I had a yearning for that sense of connection, that larger connection. And giving up Jesus as I knew him was a necessary part of my spiritual development. But it also left a void. And for me, as an adult, that mystical sense of connection is where I found that. I realized in looking at the mystics, in reading them, in listening to them, in feeling what they said, and sort of dancing with their poetry, that there was that sense of connectedness without letting go of your intellect, without letting go of your... It's sort of a way for liberals to be fundamentalists. Not fundamentalist in the sense of literal, but fundamentally connected to each other, to the universe, to the beauty that is within and around us. That's what I was had, what I had missing in that Jesus connection, and that's what I found through the mysticism. Stephen Hawking has a great statement, though, that I've thought about every once in a while. And that cynical voice still moves within me. He said that mysticism is for people that can't do the math. And I suppose there may be something in that that's true, because I've never been good at math. But I believe that that connection is even there for the people that can do the math. The Gospel of Thomas talks about if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. Certainly an image of Jesus that got pushed down and pushed away. The Jesus that became a part of Christian history was the more dominant religion. That idea that Jesus was the only way. That the only way to have what was within is to take Jesus within. But the Gospel of Thomas portrays a Jesus who said, "Don't make me the hero. Don't make me the one that allows you to opt out and abdicate your responsibilities, but recognize that that divinity or that sense of beauty or connectedness or that presence that is within and all around is within you too, that you have whatever it is that you need already. You don't even need me, in a sense," which is a powerful legacy, and you can see why the church had such a difficult time embracing that viewpoint. But I believe that's one of the images that at least the Gospel of Thomas shares. And who knows what Jesus actually said? But if he's going to say anything, and if I'm going to draw from anything, this is one I like. You know? It's good. It's good stuff. And the strength of this saying, to me, is that no one can tell us what we need. And no one can tell us what the truth really is. We are the only ones that know what we believe and what we feel. And that richness is within. But not just within, but it's a connection that we share with all. One of my favorite mystics is Francis of Assisi, who recognized that divinity was not something that you found in the authorities of his day. But he could go out into nature itself and see the fullness of divinity in a blade of grass. Or, especially, and this was so radical in his day and is in our day as well, he could see that fullness of divinity in the poor and in the oppressed, and understood that unless we have that kind of spiritual journey, we're missing the whole thing. And of course, he challenged that patriarchal system. It was to their benefit to say that only those who were the experts, the priests, the learned, could define divinity. And Francis pushed that system to the edge by saying, "No, it's everywhere. It's within all of us, and it surrounds all of us." So I like that, and I think that that connection is needed today more than ever. Today, in this weekend, we recognize that those mystical connections are not just the touchy-feely, beauty, aesthetic connections, but like Francis, we recognize that we are all connected to each other in profound ways that recognize the pain and the struggle and the oppression. Martin Luther King talked about that inescapable web that connects all things. And in his own spiritual journey, a journey that began with work for civil rights, for African Americans, and then began to shift to something even broader, so that it became for the poor in general. And then in his opposition to the Vietnam War, his advocacy for peace, he saw them all as part of a larger movement of greater connection. And so it wasn't just the beauty of the sun hitting a barn that brought tears to his eyes, but it was the interconnectedness of everyone and everything's pain together that needed interrupted. That perhaps divinity really needs to be expressed not just when we stop and notice, but when we interrupt those systems, those things in our society and in our own hearts that doesn't allow us to see the interconnections. It doesn't allow us to see divinity from within and without. A couple of weeks ago, I visited my sister who has just moved to Birmingham, Alabama. And she said to me after a couple of days, "So, what do you think of Birmingham?" And I said, "It's really pretty here." And she said, "What else?" And I said, "It's really pretty here. I like Austin." But we went to visit the Civil Rights Institute, which is right downtown at the place where Bull Connor opened up the hoses, and right there next to the church where the four young girls died in the bombing. And it was such a powerful feeling of connection, a powerful feeling of tears and sadness to be there in the midst of that. And in walking through the museum with my nephew, who's 6 years old, a precocious little kid who's just full of life and questions, there's a particularly interesting room that has 3D glass figures throughout, various kinds of people, different races, genders, adult, children, etc. And as you walk past them, voices would come on, and you got the sense of being in this crowd, even in the midst of being alone. But at the very end of the room was a Klan outfit encased in a figurine that was clear glass, and so it looked almost ghostly. It looked frightening, because it was in the shape of a human. And he'd never seen anything like that before. And he was running ahead of everybody. And he ran back and grabbed a hold of my hand and said, "Uncle Sid, come here." And we looked at it and he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, that is an outfit of the Ku Klux Klan, what we call the KKK. And he said, "What's that?" And I thought, you know, how do you, a six-year-old, how do you do this, you know? And I said, "Well, they're white people who don't like black people, and they do bad things." I mean, I'm, you know, using real simplistic expressions here, but they have to hide behind the mask because there's a part of them that knows that it's wrong, and they're ashamed. And he said, "I think we should get our laser guns and blow them away." And I'm thinking, I said, "Well, you know, the best way to fight the KKK is to treat everybody the same, is to love everyone. And we can change the world if we do that." And I'm thinking, okay, that's just way too much for a six-year-old. But he clung on to it. And at that moment, he turned around, and there was an older African-American couple walking up just behind us. And that little boy looked at them, and he said, "This is a KKK outfit." And he repeated back almost word for word what I had said to him. He says, "They're bad white people who don't like black people, but we shouldn't shoot them with laser guns. We should treat everybody the same, and that's the best way to fight them." And this couple looked at this little white kid, and they had tears in their eyes. And I realize that, you know, he's going to repeat that, hopefully, through his life. But even if he doesn't, in that moment, there was profound healing that happened for this couple to see and experience that. That web of life that Martin Luther King talked about, that idea that injustice against anyone is injustice against everyone. And whether it's the sun shining on a barn, whether it's our moving, with the rhythm of the Gospel of Thomas and a Jesus who understood that within everyone lies a particular kind of divinity, or it's standing at a civil rights institute in Birmingham, Alabama. The legacy that we can bring to our own spirituality today on this weekend commemorating Martin Luther King is to step forth into that kind of courage, into that kind of mystery, and hold on to that beauty that we all share. I invite you to be a part of that journey with me. Amen.